Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Episode 2 of Australasian Science. So we're getting into the main articles now, and this one is about how the Earth's orbit affects the actual overall climate. So obviously if the Earth is... its axis of rotation is parallel to its orbital axis. That is, the equator, the sun's dead ahead on the equator all the time. You'll have no seasons, the poles will be very cold. Then, as the Earth's axis varies, it get greater seasons, and eventually you'll get a big summer and winter, and always very low flux of light at the poles, so it'll be sort of so cold at the equator, so it'll get there. Now, the interesting thing here is that the Earth is very stabilized by the moon. So the moon's like a gigantic flywheel stabilizing stuff, so it stabilizes our orbit. But our orbit routinely squeezes, becomes more or less elliptical as it does. So conservation of angular momentum means that the axis turns around. So I don't know what they're going to say in this particular article. So I think it's every 100,000 years, the Mivoskin cycle, named after the person who discovered that someone else had discovered it before, so this means that our pole changes, so we get a shift there. There's also a similar time period of us travelling through the galaxy, and different galactic conditions impinge on this, on the solar weather, it goes through. Now, without a moon, the axis varies wildly, and so this, for Mars, the axis really turns a lot more because there's not the same moons to move over there. What I find rather interesting is that does the axis move, do the moons travel at an angle to the axis? So that would be interesting stuff. So this is a really important thing. So a different angle on Earth's climate history. The Earth's axial tilt affects our environment in many ways, but a much greater tilt in the remote geological past may have strongly influenced the planet's climate history and the evolution of life. Well, they're going to have to establish why there was, rather than just pluck evidence out of the thing, to say why there was a much greater tilt. Because the problem is that if you do have a greater tilt, it generally is a... in interaction, or we've got Uranus is permanently like that on a circular orbit. So you get the more elliptical orbit, the more your tilt can vary. So it's, yeah, just how it could possibly change, because there's a sort of angular momentum involved in this. Okay, here's some dot points. Do you know, first point, the seasons of warm summers, cool winters in the middle latitude, large seasonal temperature changes in the high latitudes, and so what controls and a consistent equatorial climate? Okay, to the meridional temperature gradient, which runs north-south, to explain why Darwin is warmer than Hobart and why high latitudes have ice sheets while equators are it's hot. Dendritic direction of oceanic circulation. Important features of the environment are controlled by the tilt of the Earth's spin on the axis relative to the perpendicular plane of the Earth's orbit around the Sun. I like that's well expressed. The tilt is turned an obliquity to the ecliptic, and varies between, this ecliptic is the plane of orbit, varies between 22 and 24 degrees on a cycle of 41,000 years. Now, in brackets, that should say 41 ka. Put KA next to it. Now, the interesting, that's the something or other cycle. The present day obliquity of 23.4 global seasonal temperature variation is mostly moderate, with poles cold and equator hot. The meridional temperature gradient controls the general direction of oceanic circulation. with cold, cold, dense water sinking at the poles and upwelling at the lower latitudes, where it is driven by surface winds. Oh, I didn't know that one. This process transports heat, fresh water, carbon around the globe. The Likert cycle of 41 Ka, which they've put correctly, together with other orbital cycles affecting the Earth, is a movement around the Sun. As an influence on the planet's climate cycles, as shown by the advance and retreat of glaciers during the past few million years. But the obliquity remained near 23 throughout Earth's. But has the obliquity remained near 23 degrees throughout Earth's 4.45 billion years history? After all, the outer planet Uranus has an obliquity of 97.9, so it seems to be lying on the side. Likewise, Mars, which lacks a stabilizing gravitational influence of a large moon, reached an obliquity of greater than 70 degrees since 300 million years ago, MA, which means with a mean of 14.8 degrees compared to the current obliquity of 25.2. Intriguingly, geological and geophysical observations imply that the Earth's obliquity in remote past was also much greater than the current value. Very hard to see what mechanism. I hope you've got a mechanism here. During the past 40 years, we have studied the glacial deposits of the Neoproterozoic Age, 470 to 635 million years ago in South Australia. Now, South Australia, remarkably, is big. I can't remember. A famous geologist was in Antarctica, then went out to Arkaroola and saw glacial rocks just dropped around and realised that there was glaciation in South Australia, now a desert, continental drift. In South Australia, Canada and Alaska, and the Paleoproterozoic Age in Western Australia, which is 180 million years ago, and Canada 230 million years ago. Okay, so the glacial deposits both. Our work suggests that using paleomagnetism, the study of ancient magnetism of rocks, showed that, curiously, marine glacial deposits older than 635 million years old in Australia and North America formed at paleolatitudes lower than 20 degrees. I don't know what that really means. Paleolatitudes are what that means, that, I'm just staggered because these people, the continents move about the place. Paleolatitudes are revealed by determining the direction of magnetism locked into iron-bearing minerals within rocks at or soon after the time the rocks were formed. Numerous independent paleomagnetic studies on other continents support our findings. Importantly, no glaciation has been identified in the paleolatitudes higher than 40 degrees prior than 635 million years, when only primitive life forms and bacteria and glacier prevailed Earth. This is important. 550 to 525, you've got the sudden explosion of life, and then another 100 million years easily, and then life emerges onto land. A frigid, strongly seasonal, late Neoproterozoic 465 to 645 to 635 million years ago. Okay, so it's strongly seasonal. Glacial climate is indicated by sandy wedges several metres deep in South Australia, Northwest Africa, Europe and Greenland. The sand wedges in South Australia are identical in dimensions and structure to sand wedges now forming in polar permafrost regions, such as the Arctic Dry Valley, under extreme seasonal temperature changes. Winter and summer mean monthly air temperature differences of about 40 degrees Celsius. My only problem here, my friend, is that those temperature sensors aren't happening in Antarctica. So, But let's see, the wedges would form if you do have temperature variations, you do have a lot of things. Such wedges are from the vertical thermal contraction cracks, several meters deep, in the upper permafrost during severe winters. Okay, so the top freezes and contracts, and so it lifts up, I suppose. The cracks filled with windblown sand, and repeated cracking and filling over many years produces sand wedges that push aside and upturn adjacent material as they grow. A strongly seasonal climate is so implied by the existence of ancient laminated marine and glacial lake deposits that are comparable to modern seasonally laminated deposits that are found in the polar regions. Well, except the polar regions, you know, we're not having it there, but you can imagine that if you freeze the top layer, that's going to contract and lift up, and sand can blow in, and then when it goes down again, it eventually lifts up. The seeming contradictory finding of low-latitude marine glaciation with strongly seasonal climates may be explained if the Earth's obliquity was greater than 54 degrees or a continental drift, with computer models finding that, oh, it's seasonal variation which forms, I suppose. The equator would be cooler than the poles on average, and low latitudes would be glaciated preferentially. High latitudes around times of summer solstice, it would be too hot for the accumulation of snow and development of high latitude ice sheets. Okay, so the it's sort of like the permanent melting. So although it would be very cold, it would only build up one season's worth of cold. It's got to be permanently. It's the ice sheets form when the temperature never reaches above ice formation. Very large seasonal air temperature ranges mean monthly differences between 40 degrees Celsius would affect all continents, including those at low altitude. Meridional temperature gradients and general direction of global oceanic circulation would be reversed relative to the present day, and only primitive life forms could exist because of the extreme seasonal stresses. Significantly, glaciers, landforms in low latitudes in Mars, interpreted as interplanetary science by planetary scientists as evidence of glacial activity at the time of Mars high obliquity. I think it's varying. I think varies in and out. These findings support the concept of low latitude glaciation at times of high planetary obliquity. So there's something to do with the shape of the orbit, I suppose, as well. So, of course, now we have it's slightly closer to the sun at summer, so we're travelling slightly faster through space. There's a glacial rock sitting in there, and whaler sandstone. Oh, look, it's upturning. Cattle. The brekkie is just rubbish. Someone's hammer is there. Oh, small, look, it's really small. Oh, sorry for talking about this. This is really interesting. Can I say this is super interesting? What a fantastic science magazine. Let's read the three generations of late neopreic sand wedges in the frost-shattered form of permafrost, cattle grid breccia, and sandstone. Oh, wow. Oh, that's what it means. Indicating that a frigid, strongly seasonal climate prevailed thousands of years near the former equator at Mount Gunston, South Australia. Okay, well, that's right. It was the equator. We sort of drifted down and up. Field exposure of the B Paleoprenozoic 230 million-year-old seasonally laminated mudstone, siltstone, sandstone, with the stones dropped by floating ice, indicating that strongly seasonal glacial climate occurred near the former equator, Ontario, Canada. That's B. I can't see the rocks, but oh, you definitely do see the odd rock in this thing. Enlargement of C, enlargement of B, showing pale summer layers of sandstone and siltstone deposited by meltwaters with sandy pellets dropped in suspension when the lake or sea froze over. These seasonally laminated rocks commonly display pairs of similar summer layers, which supports paleomagnetic evidence of the deposition occurred at low paleolatitudes. Well, that is very fascinating. This is great. I'm sorry that you're listening to well, these books. This is absolutely stand great. I love looking at this. Okay, so how might the Earth have acquired high obliquity in the remote past? I don't know. Our computer simulations have found that the impact of a Mars-sized body on Earth at 4.51 billion years ago, which may astronomers think have resulted in the Moon's formation, would likely have imparted high obliquity on the Earth's early Earth. Possibly so. Which would explain why all glacial deposits older than 63.5 million years have yielded high-quality paleomagnetic data indicate that the glaciation occurred at low paleo altitudes. Now, paleo latitudes, I'd say, attitudes. Okay, now the issue there is that you just can't, there's no magic hand which goes up, it's the actual shape of the orbit that changes. The high obliquity hypothesis for low latitude glaciation prior to the Icatarian period, which is the thing where life emits, requires Earth obliquity to have decreased in value. Near to that today, between the end of the Neoproterozoic and low paleolithic glaciation after 635 million years, and the advent of high paleolatitude glaciation in the early Cambrian 535 million years ago. So Cambrian is the time where you've got the trilobites. So it's trying to bring you. This obliquity decrease would have greatly increased the Earth's habitability by reducing seasonal stresses. Several mechanisms. So I thought we're going to have snowball Earths, but this similar came. Several mechanisms for the that is interesting. That's interesting because if you don't have a snowball Earth, you have a lot more temperature and energy being dumped into it because it's not white in snow. Several mechanisms for such decrease have been suggested, but none established. However, many decades passed before mechanisms for lateral movement of continents, slow convection of the Earth's mantle that is driven by internal heat, was identified and accepted. Although, what can I say? That's incorrect. And people don't say the slow convection. They say it's not convecting. It's just the formation chemical transport. There's a chemical transport. So it's the low melt rock forms up at the plates, and then that it just descends at the plates. Now, they're really rigid plates. So I don't think that's actually true, that bit. So they're saying we don't have an mechanism, but several, we're going with it, which is classic scientific hypothesis. The Icarian period marks the transition from the alien world of primitive life forms and the marine glaciation in low latitudes under strongly seasonal climates to the familiar world of complex life. That's true. That is the Hadean period. That's where you had archaea, their simple cells. The available paleomagnetic data suggests the marine glaciation and ice rafting of stones during the Cladian period occurred over a range of latitudes, which is consistent with the transition occurring between contrasting worlds. Okay, I think there is some evidence here. I can't see. You'd have to have a rearrangement of the solar system planets for this to happen. Global oceanic circulation may have undergone a revolution during the Euclid. You really have to say we don't know what's going on much further earlier in the article. A revolution during the Euclidean as the meridional temperature gradient reversed, i.e. it's colder in the equator. Such dramatic change in oceanic circulation would have brought oxygenated surface water to the previously oxygen-depleted deep ocean and been a catalyst for the evolution of complex marine life there at the time. Ooh, I suppose. Including the world-famous cardiobiota in biota, South Australia, which is basically the first complex big life form, was a doormat. The high obliquity hypothesis offers an explanation for the mainly puzzling features of Earth's climatic and biological records. It provides an alternative to the snowball Earth hypothesis, which is proposed the Earth was at times frozen over from pole to pole prior to the Cretaceous, with sea ice 1 kilometre thick on average. Ice sheets over 2.5 kilometres thick covering them all continents. And a hydrological cycle that shuts down for many millions of years. So I find this hard to do, because if you remove water from the atmosphere and lock it up in ice, you're not going to have erosion. I find this hard to really work. You need erosion to suck carbon dioxide. So it turns out when the Earth freezes, the carbon dioxide drops, and so we... Oh, yeah. No, the carbon dioxide can accumulate. However, geological observations indicate that the Neoproterozoic glacial environment included ice-free continental regions with widespread wind-blown dune fields. Yeah, you, there's lots of erosion happening here, isn't it, mate? Yeah, because it's beautiful. That now makes sense, because you've got these inclusions in here as things. Extensive and long-lived open seas that permitted wave-generated structures to form in the marine deposits. An active hydrological cycle and repeated glacial advances and retreats. That's right. Nor do paleo... So the light's fading here, so I'm going to find it a bit difficult to read. Permit a snowball Earth, because life forms require open oceans, refuges for a long-term survival. I would say so. Moreover, the thick ice sheets covering all continents in a snowball Earth scenario would cause extreme sea level falls of up to 1 kilometre. However, recent studies of the Neoproterozoic glacial sequences in Africa and South Australia have found no evidence of the extreme altitudes. Well, there you go. Now, Australia's altitude, we were much higher altitude, and we've just eroded down. We haven't done much, we've eroded down. And this is interesting. So that's a clincher for me. Three observations together mitigate against the snowball Earth scenario. I think you've got a good argument there. Indeed, most glacial sedimentary geologists oppose the snowball hypothesis in favour of the Earth, with some open sea terming it as a waterbelt Earth. However, neither a snowball Earth nor a waterbelt Earth can explain the extreme seasonal ocean... mean monthly air temperature differences of 40 degrees in the low paleotic latitudes, which is obviously the high obliquity and snowball Earth hypothesis. Each face challenges and continuing investigation of ancient glaciations promises to further illuminate Earth's climate history. Well, I was prepared to be extremely sceptical. I think they've made the really accurate point that one, as a scientist, has to engage with the inductive reasoning, or before inductive reasoning, you've got to have an open mind, you've got to have a naivety. There you go. This is naivety. You've got an open mind. An analytical viewpoint that perhaps there are open questions here. So let's go in from that. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story,
comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.